For antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas, I'm Scott Horton, and this is Antiwar Radio. Did Israel know about the 9/11 attacks before they happened? It's not a popular question, but my guest today has asked it. His name is Christopher Ketchum, and he's written a new article for Counterpunch, Cheering Movers and Art Student Spies. What did Israel know in advance of the 9/11 attacks? Welcome to the show, Christopher.
Good to be here.
Now, this is not a popular question, and although I kind of resent the fact that it's necessary, I sort of feel that it's necessary that before we even get into this story at all, that we have to set the record straight. I've talked to you on the phone a little bit yesterday, and I believe it is the case that you are not an anti-Semitic racist, and you are not a conspiracy lunatic who believes that, you know, the Jews shot a missile at the Pentagon or any of this craziness. You're an actual reporter, and this is an actual news story. Is that right?
I'd say that's correct.
Now, I'm sorry, because it sounds, I mean, obviously I just insulted you, but the fact of the matter is that, well, as you pointed out to me yesterday when we spoke a little bit, the I think it was the Anti-Defamation League has your story on the same page with the conspiracy theories that say that all the Jews were warned not to go to work that day and that kind of thing. Is that right?
Well, in 2003, the ADL, Abe Fox and the ADL put out a report called Unraveling 9/11 Conspiracy Theories, or something to that effect. And basically, yeah, they in that report, they lump in, you know, they lump together the notion that Israel was possibly spying on on Al-Qaeda in the United States, which has some verity to it, with, you know, these nut job conspiracy theories about how the 4,000 Jews were warned to stay out of the towers, or that Larry Silverstein profited from foreknowledge of the attacks, or that, in fact, Mossad had arranged the attacks, et cetera, et cetera. So, and that's actually rather convenient, because then it removes what is a real news story, i.e. the espionage question, and it removes it into the hinterlands of conspiracy theory, of the fringe.
Yeah, and I think really we can probably blame the conspiracy theorists more than we can blame the Israel lobby for that.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, I got to tell you, in the wake of that Counterpunch piece, I have been deluged with emails from, you know, guys, or I don't know what or who they are, but people calling me up saying, you know, connecting up the allegations of Israeli espionage with the JFK assassination and the moon landing, you know, UFOs also connected in there.
Nah, there's no end to it, really.
No, well, obviously not.
And here we are. The situation is that the waters are so muddied with all this, you know, bombs on every floor of both towers and the one across the street and a missile hitting the Pentagon and all the Jews were warned not to go to work and all that kind of stuff that, you know, frankly, the real reporters, and there are, you know, a shrinking, I think, handful of real investigative reporters in this country who are willing to take on, you know, stories even approaching this kind of thing. And even most of them seem really reluctant to even tackle this because they don't want to get thrown in with the kooks.
Yeah.
I mean,
it
must have taken, you know, real courage on your part or willingness to say, you know, fine, go ahead and smear me. I'm going to do my job anyway.
Well, you know, I haven't... You know, I wrote an article for Salon called The Israeli Art Student Mystery in 2002, and that was exploring the case of the so-called art students who were allegedly spying on the September 11th hijackers. That, of course, case is not proven, but it is very suspicious. But in the wake of that, you know, I wasn't smeared. I wasn't attacked. It was what was interesting about that story is that it was almost entirely ignored.
Yeah, which can be just as bad in a way.
Yeah, well, maybe it brings up questions that no one really wants to touch, you know. On the other hand, you know, I was speaking with the the dean of Columbia Journalism School, and he was telling me that, and I was asking, well, why doesn't the media go the major mass media or the gateway newspapers, so to speak, the New York Times, Post, et cetera, or the Washington Post, why don't they tackle these stories? And he was saying, well, you know, it probably happens every day that reporters in these mainstream in their cubicles come across a blockbuster story, and it comes across their desk or comes across an email or some anonymous caller, but they can't corroborate it. They can't get enough sources on the record to run with it. And you know, in the case of the Counterpunch piece, almost all my sources are anonymous on background only. They would not they would not allow me to use their name. So it's a hard place to be when you're sticking your neck out for anonymous sources, you know.
Yeah, and especially when it's a politically unpopular topic, like even just the very notion that the Israelis had spies following the hijackers around and didn't tell the American government everything they knew about it, which is ultimately the question here, which, you know, hang on tight, folks. We're going to go through as much of the story as we can. But to the point of the media coverage, there's been a little bit on 2020. I know you had a little bit of difficulty getting this one run, a little bit in the forward here and Dezeet there, but this has really been swept under the rug. And we're talking about a pretty major story here to have as much silence surrounding it as it does.
Well, it's one of the big unsolved stories of September 11th. But you know, just to caveat what you're just saying, the question is not just whether Israel informed the United States of all it knew. Perhaps Israel informed the United States of a lot more than the United States is admitting. And that brings up even more disturbing questions about of the failure to act to prevent September 11th.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, let's just go ahead and cut to halfway through the interview right now and talk about what you say as it's a sidebar story in your Counterpunch piece about Al-Midhar and Al-Hamzi, who I believe, according to the official legend at least, met at this Malaysia meeting where the September 11th plan was made in detail. And the CIA supposedly followed these guys to America, and the CIA claims they told the FBI, and the FBI claims that they didn't get warned until, you know, the very last minute or something. And now you're saying in your article in Counterpunch that beyond that discrepancy, that there's a question as to, how it is that the CIA knew who these guys were in the first place, that kind of thing. What's going on there?
Well, all right. The story is really, really labyrinthian, and I'll try to simplify it as much as possible. Basically, Al-Hazmi and Al-Midhar were put on an FBI watch list on August 24th of 2001. And the CIA, in their explanation to the 9/11 Commission and to the investigative committees of the House and Senate, claims that this watch listing came as the result of a long series of CIA efforts to link up Al-Hazmi and Al-Midhar with a known Al-Qaeda operative named Khalad. Okay, Khalad, Hazmi, Midhar were all supposed to have been together or been seen together at a January 2000 meeting in Kuala Lumpur where the September 11th attacks were indeed hatched. Now, when you actually look through the record, there is no identification of Khalad as having been at that meeting, which is the only reason, mind you, that the CIA found Midhar and Hazmi to be of interest, because now they were supposedly connected to Al-Qaeda. These were proven, there's a connection there. But in fact, that connection was never made. Now, Die Zeit reported that on August 22nd, the Mossad provided the names of Hazmi and Midhar to the CIA.
That's August 22nd, 2001, weeks before the attack.
2001, 2 days before the FBI put the two men's names on a watch list. But by then it was too late. They were already gone. They were already in hiding, preparing to strike. So, yeah, the explanation that the CIA gives for the watch listing of these two men just does not hold up to scrutiny.
Now, it does hold up to scrutiny that they were at that meeting in Malaysia, just not that this other guy was. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. They were apparently at the meeting, but the CIA, again, goes to tortuous lengths to set up their, to explain the watch listing by making this alleged connection with Khalid. Now, why they go to that extent, in to the absurd extent in their explanation, I don't know. But it seems like a badly woven cover story, frankly.
And you're saying indications are that the Israeli Mossad had actually identified these men to the U.S. government, and that was how they ended up on the watch list.
That's
in reality.
That's what a reporter named Oliver Schramm, freelancer in Germany, contends.
Okay.
In an article in Die Zeit that appeared in 2002, I believe.
And so that's the only article that has the date of that information being turned over?
That's correct.
Okay. And now, I've read somewhere else, and I'm sorry I can't cite my source for it, but, you know, whatever, I'm just tossing rumors at you, and you can stick to the facts. Something that said that perhaps the CIA thought that these two were Saudi intelligence and therefore were okay. And that was why they turned a blind eye. Alternative to that, you say in your article there was a possibility that the CIA wanted to flip these guys.
That's right.
And that's why they left him alone.
Lawrence Wright is a New Yorker writer and author of The Looming Tower, which is a great book. He contends that some of his sources were telling him that, that yes, indeed, CIA may have been subcontracting to Saudi intelligence to watch these guys with the ultimate purpose, possibly, of, yes, of turncoating them, of turning them into informants.
And now these are two of the hijackers from Flight 77, is that right?
Oh, I believe so. I mean, I'm not sure which flight they hijacked, but, yeah, they were among the 19.
Mm-hmm. Now, okay, so there we go, skipping all the way to the middle of the interview. Let's rewind to the beginning here. There was a 911 call made from New Jersey that said that it was a woman who said that she saw some men near a white van celebrating the attack on the first tower before the second tower had even been hit, when the vast majority of Americans, probably even in the government, didn't conclude it was an attack. Apparently, these guys already had concluded it was an attack and were celebrating, and an APB was put out, and these guys got pulled over. What happened?
Well, it wasn't APB. APB is a lot more serious. It was a BOLO, a Be On Lookout. BOLO was sent out on the afternoon of September 11th, and not long thereafter, this van, a white van, marked Urban Moving Systems, that was a van, you know, that was registered to a moving company in New Jersey, was pulled over, and the driver was carrying according to the police report, the two officers approached the van, asked the driver to step out, asked the occupant to step out. They refused to. The driver was fumbling with a black leather pouch, some type of bag. The men were then forcibly removed at gunpoint from the vehicle, placed on the grass meridian, read their rights, and they had some very interesting things to say. According to the police report, the first things out of their mouths is that we're Israelis, we're not the problem, the Palestinians are the problem. And they averred that they were Israeli and that they were on the West Side Highway during the incident, meaning the quote-unquote, meaning the attacks. And the police report makes it clear that these statements, that is, we're Israeli, we're not the problem, or the statement that we were on the West Side Highway during the incident were unprompted. That is, they had not even been told the reason that they were stopped. And already they were assuming that the reason that they were stopped is because of some sort of connection to the event, the attack. Very strange. So then the FBI was brought in, counterintelligence, the counterintelligence division of the FBI was brought in, and the case shot straight to the highest echelons in D.C., and there was just an absolute shutdown of secrecy surrounding it. The case was handled straight out of the FCI, Foreign Counterintelligence Headquarters in D.C., managed centrally from there. So it was a case of the highest importance within the ranks of the FBI.
Okay, now did I correctly characterize the 911 call that the witness saw these people celebrating?
Yeah. Now, here's another unresolved question, which I didn't get into in my counterpunch piece, simply because of space constraints, and also because it's one of these strange questions, again, surrounding this case, surrounding all this entire matter. The Israelis in their white van were supposedly seen in two places not long after or immediately after the attack. They were seen by a housewife who 2020 identifies as, I think, Mary. Mary spies these guys, sees these guys in a parking lot, in the parking lot of her apartment building. It's open-air parking lot with a good view of the towers. And they're jumping up and down and just clapping and holding up cigarette lighters, as if at a rock concert.
And now, again, this is before the second tower has been hit, right?
That's right. This is immediately after the first plane struck. Now, these men, according to the FBI, were also seen at Liberty State Park, which is about, I don't know, 10-minute drive from the location where the housewife saw these guys. So it's not implausible that they had driven between both locations immediately after the attack. But yeah, the other suspicion that FBI agents had was indeed that these men were celebrating, apparently because of the geopolitical benefit that would be had by Israel as a result of the attack. That's what they told the FBI, and that's the FBI confirmed to me on the record. Now, that implies, obviously, that they knew that this was not an accident. They knew that that first plane was a terrorist assault. Now, I was in Brooklyn at the time reporting on the attacks for Salon.com. And, yeah, I mean, after that first plane struck, nobody on earth thought it was a terrorist assault, except for Bin Laden. He knew. But these guys apparently knew something that nobody else knew. So.
Well, I didn't find out about it till later. I think it's possible some people who had been paying attention to Osama bin Laden and the threat from him might have known. I would have thought that surely the brass in the military and at the CIA would have assumed that it was an attack, not an accident. But maybe I'm giving them too much credit.
Yeah, I think you are.
Yeah, well, I hate to do that, so let's
yeah,
not
I,
go
I
further there.
For our government.
And again, this
That's,
the
you know,
driver of the
aside,
van.
Sorry, go on.
Again, the driver of the van, when the local police pulled him over, the first thing out of his mouth, he blurts, "We're Israeli. We're not your problem. The problem is the Palestinians."
That's right.
Okay. Now, I'm sorry for interrupting you. Please go ahead.
Go on.
No. That was it. I just wanted to, reiterate the point that here, first of all, these guys are for people in the audience who are not familiar with the story. There's some guys high-fiving each other, holding their lighter up like they're at a rock concert, apparently celebrating the attack on the first tower before 99.9% of anybody in America thought that it was an attack. And then when they're pulled over, they immediately, as you say, seem to know why they've been pulled over and start making excuses.
Yeah. But, one observation that I've heard from sources is that, and that always struck me, is that if these guys are trained spies, then they're pretty oafish.
That's a good point.
If they're operating for Mossad, which they were, according to the forward, according to 2020, according to sources I've spoken to, they were not very good at covering it up. I mean, dancing around like that after the attacks occur, blurting out, as you said, incriminating evidence statements almost immediately.
Well, so what is the purpose behind that, do you think? Is there?
I don't know. I mean,
you quoted one guy as saying that he thinks that maybe rather than the attack, they were celebrating how accurate they were and knowing that there was going to be an attack, maybe.
Right.
Celebrating their own prowess.
Right, that's what one source says, sure. That's very much a possibility.
Okay, yeah, so the FBI moves in, and the FBI and Washington, D.C. take this case over, and then what happens to it?
Well, the men are held for 71 days. They are repeatedly interrogated. They are they repeatedly fail lie detector tests.
So the FBI was taking this very seriously at first.
It was very seriously taken. They were held in miserable conditions in a Brooklyn confinement and federal detention center. After 71 days is up, apparently the FBI determined that there's no further reason to hold them. However, that's what they publicly stated. However, a source told me that the FBI investigators felt the case was, quote, torpedoed by the higher-ups, and that that it was never the issue of foreknowledge, that the behavior these men suggested was never resolved, and that when they were flown back in November of 2001, flown back to Israel, the case really remained an unsolved mystery.
And I guess you would have mentioned it in your Counterpunch article if any of your sources had seen the video. Supposedly there was a video camera on their person when they were arrested in New Jersey, right?
That is correct. There was some sort of video, but it was never apparently not retrieved, or perhaps lost. We don't know what happened to that video.
So you've never heard of anyone saying that they've seen it or knows that somebody has or anything?
A source of mine told me that someone he knew in FBI had seen the video.
Ah.
But you know, obviously the person in the FBI would not talk to me.
We're only a senator with subpoena power.
That's right. That's right. We need the Congress to step up to the plate here and take action on this matter.
Okay, now, I get the idea, the way you describe how the FBI originally handled this case, and from what I know of other stories about political interference and police work, the actual street cops, the gumshoes, they hate it when the White House comes and shuts down their investigation, don't they?
Yeah. Well, because they're cops. They're investigators. They want to solve. They want to get solutions. They want to get answers. So, yes, when politics interferes with investigative work, it's absolutely onerous.
All right. Now, these guys, the men arrested from the white van in New Jersey, do they have any connection to the hijackers in any way? As in terms of, you know, living nearby them, possibly surveilling them? Is there any connection between the men in the white van and the hijackers?
What do you mean, connection?
When we get into the art students, we find that many of them live down the street, seem to be monitoring them, indications, electronic surveillance, that kind of thing. I just wonder if the five guys in the van are in any verifiable way connected to the rest of that part of the story.
What we do know is that these five men were employed with Urban Moving Systems, which was itself a Mossad front. That front was being run by a guy named Dominic Suter. Dominic Suter, 2 days after his men were picked up, fled the country for Israel, abandoning his business, abandoning his home. He had a nice little home in Fair Lawn, New Jersey, which I visited. The purpose of this front that Suter was running, according to 2020 and the Forward, and according to sources I've spoken to, was electronic surveillance, remote surveillance, and on-site surveillance of Muslim extremists in the northern New Jersey community. Now, northern New Jersey, of course, was one of the locus of activities of the 9/11 hijackers. Several of the Pentagon plane hijackers lived there. Muhammad Atta visited friends there, had a mail drop there. So there was a nexus of activity between these Mossad agents who were running, you know, intel on the Muslim community and the 9/11 hijackers who were living in that same Muslim community.
I'm Scott Horton. You're listening to Anti-War Radio. I'm talking with Christopher Ketchum. He wrote Cheering Movers and Art Student Spies for the latest issue of Counterpunch. And I'd like to ask you, what does the 9/11 Commission report have to say about all this, Christopher?
Nothing.
Not a word?
Not a word. Not a word. Absolute silence. They do not touch this evidence in any way, shape, or form. It's pretty odd. It's obviously it's a political third rail. It's a political nightmare to deal with because of the pressure that the Israel lobby brings to bear with regard to issues, you know, that threaten the sanctity of the U.S. relationship. So, and this surely evidence that this surely threatens that relationship, that sanctity.
All right, now. Back in 2002, you wrote this article for Salon that was 9,000 words or something, really long article, all about the Israeli art students, separate kind of, I guess, from the story of the guys in the van in New Jersey. You had this incredibly large group of Israeli art students going around trying to sell art to DEA agents at their houses and stuff. What the heck is going on there?
We don't know. What the DEA concluded was that they were involved in, quote, some kind of intelligence gathering operation, unquote. So what kind of intelligence would these Israelis be gathering from the DEA? No idea. At the same time, it was shown that these various groups of basically young men and women traveling the country, they were found to be selling art all in many, you know, 30 different states, most in the South. One of their central nodes of activity was in the town of Hollywood, Florida, north of Miami. Now, that's an interesting coincidence with regard to the 9/11 hijackers, because 15 of the 19 hijackers lived in Hollywood, Florida. Now, if you begin to look at the actual addresses of the hijackers, Muhammad Atta in particular, and the addresses of some of these Israeli art students who are suspected to be spies, you'll find that they live literally next door to each other. Some, in one case, within 1,800 feet.
And your sources in the intelligence community are telling you they believe that these Israelis were monitoring the men who turned out to be the September 11th hijackers.
That is correct. The purpose of the art student ring was to act as a cover. Now, it seems a rather odd cover to draw attention to yourself by purposely canvassing DEA agents. These art students were not just attempting to sell art to DEA agents. They were penetrating office buildings where you had the Secret Service offices, FBI, you name it. Several different bureaucratic arms of the U.S. federal government were penetrated by these art students.
Yeah, now, you say in the article, Secret Service, the Marshal Service. Basically, any kind of federal cop, these guys were trying to get in the side doors, snooping around parking garages.
Yeah, that's right. Very strange, very strange. Now, why would they, if they were conducting an intelligence operation against the 9/11 hijackers, then why draw so much attention to yourself from very people who you don't want to get attention from?
Sure, and particularly the DEA, what do they have to do with anything?
Well, you know, one source of mine told me that a guy in Mossad told him that every time U.S. investigators started to sort of plumb the depths or plumb the meaning of these art students, that the art students would toss out purposely an ecstasy connection so that to make U.S. investigators believe that, in fact, what they were involved in, these art students, that is, was ecstasy trafficking, thus the DEA connection.
So basically, Mossad sends dozens or hundreds of Israeli people to go around America trying to sell art, and a select handful of them are actually intelligence agents, and they're being covered by all this bumbling nonsense.
That's right. That's right. I mean, it's
But that can't be true because Israel doesn't spy in the United States.
Of course, of course. We all know that. No, Israel has a long history of spying in and against the U.S. That's to any reader of antiwar.com. They're familiar with that history, no doubt.
Yeah, trial starts in June. Be sure to tune in. So how many help me out. Large numbers, total art students, and then how many actual agents are we talking about here, do you think?
Well, apparently there were some 120 art students. Of them, maybe two dozen were spies, but we don't know. We don't know for certain. Now, after September 11th, this, prior to September 11th, these 120 art students were rounded up. After September 11th, another 60 another 60 young Israeli nationals were picked up, also involved in selling art and in running running a vending stand called Zoom Copter, selling little toys, trinkets in Florida. We don't know, though, whether these 60 Israelis were picked up after September 11th were connected to an intelligence operation or to Mossad. It's uncertain. See, the uncertainty in this story, that's the problem with reporting the story out, and again comes back to, it's germane to the fact that the major media outlets wouldn't touch it. There's a lot of uncertainty here. There's a lot of more questions. I think that at the end of my article, there are more questions than answers.
Yeah, by a long shot. And I guess back to the original question where this interview started was perhaps my mistaken assumption that they didn't tell the Americans everything they knew. I mean, I just assumed that based on the fact that my government says so, but that'd be a pretty silly thing to do, go with what they say, just because they said it.
I wouldn't trust the U.S. government, no.
So in your experience with this story and talking to all these varied and different sources, do you believe that the Americans were kept in the dark about this or not? That hey, look, there's this cell, they're connected with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and, you know, et cetera.
Do I believe that the United States was warned by Mossad with all of the information that Mossad had?
Yeah, or even a substantial part of it. I guess the TV news says that they gave us a general warning that you should look out, but what about
right,
that
the
there's Al-Qaeda
general,
in America?
The warning was general and nonspecific, and one source of mine said that it was the generality of that warning was due to the fact that otherwise it would have compromised. That is, if it became more specific, a more specific warning, it would have compromised sources and methods in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
i.e. the spying operation that Mossad was most definitely running in New Jersey and possibly in Florida in the guise of the art students.
Well, it seems like they could have made the decision that it would be worth it to say, all right, well, we have some spies in there looking around, but check out what they found out.
Right.
I mean, what are friends for, right?
Well, you're not supposed to, allies, you're not supposed to spy on each other. So, but there's, you know, there's a tacit gentleman's agreement between the U.S. and Israel that allows spying on their mutual soils. So, yes, in the case of such a terrific event, presumably an ally would disclose fully what the information that it had gleaned from its operations in U.S. soil, i.e., possible foreknowledge of the attack.
I'm reminded of Victor Ostrovsky's book, By Way of Deception. He says that from the point of view of Israeli intelligence, America better tell them everything. But when it comes to telling the Americans things that the Americans need to know, well, they're big boys. They can take good care of themselves.
Yeah. Well, you know, Israel is a country under siege. It's been at war for almost the entirety of its existence. So it's when you live in an environment like that, you become ruthless, and Israeli intelligence takes no prisoners. They are very effective and very very powerful, just in terms of how they can work in tandem with the Israel lobby in the U.S. and with the many pro-Israel elements in the U.S., not just talking about the Israel lobby, but, you know, the Zionist coalition, the Christian Zionist coalition, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And as you know, the look, for example, at the AIPAC trial that's coming up. Rosen and who is it? Rosen and Weissman,
right?
Two AIPAC lobbyists who were connected with Larry Franklin, and then handing off documents that Franklin had provided, handing those documents off to the Israeli embassy or attaché at the Israeli embassy. And, of course, you know that the Israeli embassy is rife with Mossad agents.
Something that came up in your article was a company called Amdocs. Where do I know them from?
Amdocs is a telecommunications firm that provides a very specific and effective software for keeping track of phone records and telephone billing. Their software is in use in the U.S. government and in use, according to one report, in the 25, you know, the biggest telecom companies in the U.S. The connection with this story was that one of the Israeli art students was bailed out on a $10,000 bail by an employee of Amdocs. Now, Amdocs, according to Carl Cameron of Fox News, who did an investigation of Amdocs, Amdocs has been repeatedly investigated by U.S. counterintelligence people at FBI for leaking data, for creating, allegedly fashioning trap doors in their software, which then allows for third parties remotely to tap into that software when it's in use in otherwise or what should be secure operations, i.e., for example, the U.S. government purchases some Amdocs software and starts using it in its telephone systems in, say, the White House, DOD, DIA, CIA. And with trapdoors installed, foreign intelligence can then, foreign intelligence being Mossad in this case, can then tap into those secure informational communication networks. Now, again, they were investigated. None of this was proven. So it's a case that, again, another unresolved case.
Yeah, another little tangent of this story that probably an unanswered question that'll stay that way, I guess.
And hopefully not. About 200 years from now, this will all be revealed through one of my FOIA requests.
Yeah, either that or 200 years from now, whatever the New York Times refuses to say about this will be the official history.
That's right.
And no one will remember your articles at all.
Yeah, there's a much higher degree of likelihood of that happening than
no
revelation, I'll tell you that.
Yeah. Now, again, I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. I'm talking with Christopher Ketchum, and he wrote this thing, Cheering Movers and Art Student Spies for Counterpunch, about, I think this part of it is undisputed fact that some Israeli Mossad agents were following the 9/11 hijackers around this country before the attack, and apparently did not come off with all the information they knew to the government of the United States. And, Christopher, I'm reminded of the fact that the day, I believe it was on September 11th, Benjamin Netanyahu was asked, what does this mean for Israel? And he said, it's very good.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he immediately backed down and said, I didn't mean that. I just mean that, yeah, it is very good for Israel to have America define its enemies in basically Israeli terms, right? Enemies are theirs. Our policy is theirs.
I think, though, you have to distinguish something. I don't know. Look at what's happened in the Middle East as a result of the 9/11 attacks. We're in Iraq now. The place is more destabilized. It's a godforsaken mess. Now, has that been a benefit to Israel? No. I think it's been horrific. However, it's been very beneficial to the militarist nationalists who have taken over Israel, the people who collude with the arms industry in this country to perpetuate warfare in the Middle East. So, yes, Benjamin Netanyahu, right-wing Yahoo that he is, said it right. It was very good for certain militarist elements in Israel. Yes.
And let's get back to the media pressure a little bit. We talked about before how very few people in the mainstream media or of real investigative reporters are willing to take this on. But 2020 did for a little while. And you say in your article that there was tremendous pressure put on ABC News. The president of ABC News had phone calls to him. Barbara Walters was personally hassled over it.
Yes, that is the case. And it's not a rare thing. I mean, it happens all the time that when mainstream media tackles difficult questions regarding Israel, that they are mercilessly assaulted to back down.
After Carl Cameron did his four-part study, you report that they basically were put in the position they had to make a deal with the Anti-Defamation League. Look, if you stop spamming us and crashing our server, we promise to take the story down off our website.
Yep, that's correct. Apparently, according to a source of mine at Fox News, the Fox News executives sat down for a meeting with Abe Foxman of the ADL. Foxman said, what are you guys doing? You know, you're killing us, or words to this effect. And the result was that Fox News agreed to remove the story from its archives, remove the transcript from its website. And then the kicker to all this is that several days after Cameron's series had aired, the transcript then disappears. And what remained on the webpage was a message: "This story no longer exists." So flushed down the what did Orwell call it? The memory hole.
Yeah, right. Where the furnace is in the basement there.
Yeah.
And you know, I think that's really its own news story itself. I mean, Carl Cameron is no dove. This is Fox News we're talking about. Fox News Channel, Rupert Murdoch, and you know, Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity and all those, you know, right-wing cheerleaders, they can't stand up to the White House on this, even they?
I don't think it's the White House. It's the Israel lobby that we're talking about. And, I mean, I don't know if Carl Cameron probably had nothing to do with the decision-making up in the executive suite. You know, in the major corporate media, it's get along to go along. Everyone's scratching each other's backs. And the way business is done. And that's why, you know, in my case, the Israel lobby isn't coming after me because I'm on the margins, you know?
Yeah, they have decided to ignore you instead.
Yeah, yeah. Why waste time?
Well, you know, I don't know how much good it'll do you, but for what it's worth, I'm trying to get your story out as best I can and at least make it the kind of thing that they have to smear you over rather than just turning a blind eye.
Ah, thanks a lot, Scott.
Yeah, well, you know, I do what I can. And, you know, I would be neglecting my responsibilities if I didn't mention that Justin Raimondo at Antiwar.com was the first person to notice this mysterious story about Israelis being rounded up in the Washington Post and to suspect that there was something nefarious going on.
Oh, I got to say, it was Raimondo's reporting on this in his column that got me on the trail to produce that Salon story in 2002, and then again the Counterpunch piece. So yeah, kudos to Raimondo.
And I wish I had a recording of it. I remember hearing a radio interview of Carl Cameron on 550 AM in San Antonio by Carl Wigglesworth, where he really got into detail on all this stuff. It was so long ago, I really wish I had a recording of it. Maybe I can call 550 AM and get a copy of that. But he came on and said, you know, basically that the cops he's talking to are saying that these guys, well, basically, as he said in his reporting, that they didn't have a direct hand in 9/11, but they seemed to know that it was going to happen and didn't take appropriate measures to warn the Americans. And now, I know how it is for the average guy driving around. Christopher Ketchum writes a story for Counterpunch. Yeah, that might be interesting. But when Fox News does a four-part special, basically confirming everything that you're saying here today, you know, I guess depending on who you are, that ought to grant it some extra credibility, right?
Yes.
rather than, you know, Fox News is usually full of it. In this case, it's more like even Fox News says so.
Well, actually, only Fox News said so. In terms of the other mainstream outlets, no one else followed up on the story. There was just dead silence as a result of it. Similarly, after 2020 came out with its piece in June of 2002 regarding the urban moving systems Mossad cell, there was dead silence. After the Forward came out with its investigation into the same urban moving cell in May of 2002, there was dead silence.
Yep, just keep sweeping it under the rug and hope it goes away finally. Now, what am I missing here? Oh, I know. I meant to ask you about some of these guys going on TV in Israel. What did they say?
They went on to a talk show. They seemed very contrite and abused by the whole experience. Apparently, they've been maltreated in the Brooklyn Detention Center where they're being held, which is probably true. They told the interviewer that they were documenting the event that day. And by documenting the event, they specifically referred to how Israel experiences terror daily, that they have a long sort of cultural political experience of terrorism, so that their purpose, again, was to quote-unquote document the event. We come back, of course, to the question of how did they know that this was a terrorist event immediately after that first plane hit the North Tower.
Right. Now, is there any evidence to say that they were already there waiting for it before the first plane even hit?
Yes. There is. I have sources telling me that some people in FBI believe that they were there prior to the attacks. My sources at ABC News at 2020 tell me that they, in investigating this piece, they concluded that they were there prior to the attacks. One source, an ex-CIA guy, told me that there are basically two stories circulating in government circles among the investigators looking into this. One was that they were there immediately, or they were there prior to the plane hitting the North Tower, or arrived immediately after. But, again, the issue was never resolved.
All right, now, are there any other major questions that should have been on my list that I've neglected to ask you here?
Probably thousands. I mean, in my piece, I have a nice listing of some of the questions that really need to be answered. I mean, one of them is one of the most important, one that you have repeatedly referenced. It's really, did the U.S. government get more advanced information about the attacks from Israel than it's willing to admit? That's a serious one. I would really like to see that answered. And also the whole question of did the CIA know that the Israelis were operating on U.S. soil? Did they abet the operation? Did they subcontract to Mossad to track the Israelis?
Right, because the CIA, at least at that time, hopefully still now, they'd be banned from domestic operations, right?
That's right. It's illegal to do so. It's also legal to hire foreign intelligence to do so, but perhaps they felt that some sort of cover, or at least cover was necessary.
I guess when it comes to the question of whether the Americans knew more than they're willing to admit to us, and it seems like every single angle on this story that's been covered so far by others, they've known more than they've said so far. I don't know why this one would be any different, really.
Yeah, it does. That has repeatedly come out.
Well, that's interesting. You know, I've always thought it would be fun to try to get someone from the FBI and someone from the CIA on the air at the same time to fight about when who was warned about Al-Midhar and Al-Hamzi. But now I guess I could even add a new wrinkle to that, which was how the CIA even came to suspect these guys in the first place, huh?
Yeah. Now, the person who really dug into this, into the Al-Midhar and Hazmi question, and the question of their watch listing, was not a reporter, but a retired corporate lawyer named Gerald Shea, who in 2004 produced a 166-page memo that, in very straight, cogent, lawyerly fashion, put together all the available evidence surrounding alleged 9/11 connected Israeli espionage. And it's a brilliant memo. People should read it. It was publicized at antiwar.com last year. It's archived on my website, ChristopherKetchum.com. Readers should check it out. There's a series of maps in there that that clearly show the various nexuses of activities of alleged Israeli spies and the future hijackers, or others suspected of having connection to the hijackers. But it was Shea who brilliantly tackled the question of Almidar and Hazmi's watch listing and the CIA's absurdist account of how that came to be. So people should check out Shea's memo.
And I also, I'm not sure, but I believe that Shea's memo is also archived in the Israeli art student files in the left-hand margin there at antiwar.com as well.
Excellent. Good.
As well as your previous article for Salon.com, which was titled The Israeli Art Student Mystery. And is Counterpunch going to go ahead and put your whole article online eventually?
They're going to put it up. What's the date today? 22nd?
Yeah.
They're saying around March 1. So it's going to go up on the website for all to read.
Okay, well, for people who can't wait, go to counterpunch.com and subscribe.
.org.
Oh, well, I think it's both, right? It forwards.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah, but yeah, you're right. It is supposed to be counterpunch.org. And subscribe. They got a pretty decent rate going on there for Counterpunch, and you will get this cover story, Cheering Movers and Art Student Spies, What Did Israel Know in Advance of the 9/11 Attacks, by Christopher Ketchum. Thanks very much for your time today, Christopher.
All right, thanks a lot. Oh, and one more thing I want to mention for listeners. Al Jazeera is apparently working on a documentary based on the Counterpunch article. So.
Oh, really? That's great.
Yes, keep it for 40 million viewers, apparently, in the worldwide. So I'll keep definitely antiwar.com will be the first to know.
Yeah, well, and depending on how long that takes from now, hopefully if a little bit of time has passed, I'll go ahead and get you back on the show to talk all about that.
That'd be great.
Wow. And when do you expect that to...
Don't know. They're filming over the next couple of days.
Okay.
They're filming me.
Great. Wow, well, we'll definitely be looking forward to seeing that on TV, even if it's on TV everywhere but the United States.
Right.
And antiwar.com.
Okay.
All right, well, thanks very much for your time.
All right, thanks, Jeff.